This is Film Weekly, and I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, Thornbirds and Against All Odds star Rachel Ward discusses her new career as a director with her film Beautiful Kate, about the painful mysteries of a stern father and a lost twin in the outback of Australia. Author Demetrius Matthew joins me to talk City of God and Central Station as we celebrate his book of new South American cinema. And Zan Brooks will be joining me to look at Catherine Zeta-Jones in The Rebound, Andy Garcia in City Island, and a sentimental slice of Sicily in Bardia. Yes, it's Around the World in about 30 minutes. It's Film Weekly.
What did you do?
Huh?
Did you pay the blacks to come and get her?
What money have I got left to give anyone?
She just got your number.
You're a fucking liar, Bruce.
Sooner or later.
You're a liar.
I did you
a favor. And a bully. You killed Cliff, and you're still at it.
Why don't you fucking hurry up and die before I kill you myself, just for the pleasure of it?
That's Brian Brown there, and Ben Mendelsohn as father and son caught in grief and rage in a scene from Rachel Ward's directorial debut feature film Beautiful Kate. Mendelsohn plays Ned, a writer who's summoned by his sister, played by Rachel Griffiths, back to his rural hometown to say goodbye to his dying father. His return stirs up violent emotions in the family around the memory of his twin sister and her death. So to tell me more about making the film, I'm delighted to say that Rachel Ward joins me on the line now. Not in Australia, you're in the UK, because you're from the UK, is right? I think people
I am, yes.
Yeah. Welcome to Film Weekly.
From outside Oxford.
Outside Oxford. So how the extraordinary journey that a girl from outside Oxford ends up making directing a film about the outback in Australia.
Yeah, I suppose it is quite a circular journey, isn't it? Very. I don't know how I got there, but it's quite a few years in between.
Yeah, there was. I mean...
Slowly, that's where I ended up, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I think people obviously will remember you Thornbirds-wise.
Yeah.
Is that how you ended up in Australia, from that?
No, really, I'd already begun a quite circuitous route way before that, because I left England really when I was about 19, and I went to live in New York, and I was modelling, and then I started acting. And then I moved to L.A., and was doing, it was about my third or fourth job I think I got in LA was the Thornbirds, and there I met Brian Brown, who became my future husband, and as you do, he says, do you want to come and live on the other side of the world? And I went, yeah, why not?
And Brian Brown, of course, is the star, well, he's one of the stars of your film, playing the irascible paterfamilias in this. He obviously was easy for you to cast him, because he was sort of
Wasn't that easy, because he didn't see himself playing that role at all, and I can't think why not, because I think he just needed to roll out of bed and play it. But I think when an actor gets to the point when you're playing dying old men, it's quite confronting.
Yes,
and he certainly doesn't see himself as that. So.
No, exactly. But it's a stretch for the acting. You see, we don't have to see Brian as that, because he can still be active and outdoorsy as we like to see him.
Yeah, and that's really, you know, what he is, obviously. So to be playing this this old codger who's on his last, you know, on his last breaths. Yeah, he thought he was way too young to play it, and I kept on having to reassure him that he was not too young to play it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's a story about family. It's a story about the landscape as well. Is it a place, I don't know where you shot the film, South Australia?
Yeah, South Australia, in a place called the Flinders Ranges, which is not an area that we've seen very much on Australian film. I mean, usually when you see outback environments, it's sort of the flat red earth and the endless sort of landscape and fly-blown country and stuff, and this is a very sort of magnificent, almost sort of haunted part of Australia that has a, you know, this very, very, actually the oldest mountain range in the world is where we shot it, in the Flinders Ranges.
Right, and it is one of those typical outbacks where there's not a lot of life going on. There's small communities separated by vast distances between schools.
Exactly. And I think that's really what why I wanted to film there, because it played into this whole theme of isolation, which I felt was one of the mitigating circumstances that led to the transgressions committed by this family.
Yeah, I mean, it's a maelstrom that you go into for a director. What was it that attracted you to this story? Because
it is
quite strong.
The maelstrom, I think. I guess what I found fascinating about it was there was transgression, but I find it very understandable how and why these kids had got to the place where they were confusing sexual love with platonic love. And they were isolated and they had no mother, and the father was neglectful, really, and, you know, dealing with his own sense of failure and his own failing farm and his failing ambitions. And, you know, they were really left to run wild.
Yeah, I mean, you bring a great sensuality to the film. It is, obviously, as you say, it is about sexual transgression in a way, but it is done very very sensually.
Thank you, Jason.
Well, good. Well, I've spotted it. But, I mean, but you're also sensitive about the landscape as well. You sort of...
Yeah, I think I remember what I found exotic about Australia when I first moved there. I mean, I definitely found that vastness and that quite sort of haunted landscape very exotic, and the sound of the birds and the sort of rattling corrugated iron and the barbed wire with the tufts of sheep's wool in it and those vast sheep shearing sheds and the cockies with which are the cowboys with their spurs and their hats. I mean, it really is frontier country, and it's really the last frontier in the Western world anyway. So I think that I found very exotic, and I kind of never forgot that. So I also felt that it was really Australia's most enduring export, and I think it's really what we want to see about Australia. I don't really feel we need to see one more city. I mean, our cities, although, you know, places like Sydney are obviously extraordinarily beautiful, they're pretty much interchangeable with any other major city in the world. But our landscape is very unique. And for me, I love stories set against exotic landscapes, places I don't know, places that I can spend, you know, what it is at the moment, £14 or whatever it is at the cinema. Is that what it costs? £7? What is it to go to the cinema?
It depends where you go these days. Right. Multiplex, boutiques,
well,
wherever.
Bloody well worth it at the Curzon, I would like to point
yeah, exactly.
out.
Exactly. Nice comfort.
But, you know, and that for that, you can be transported to another world, another culture, another landscape.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because as we mentioned the Thornbirds, of course, I know you're inextricably entwined with that. But, that was a story of frontier people set against exotic landscapes. Yeah. You are framed every time one thinks of Rachel. You're sort of framed by rolling
seas,
sand.
And I think actually the films that really had an enormous influence on me as a child were Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid or Far From the Madding Crowd, which were, again, people set against exotic landscapes, you know, in isolation and dealing with not only each other, but with the elements.
You were known for your modelling, as you say, and sort of being a great beauty of that time. Was it difficult to then kind of say, well, I want to be a director, I want to take up the camera, rather than kind of, you know, be in front of it?
No, I don't think it was difficult. It was just a gradual evolvement. I mean, as an actress and a model, you pass your use-by date very quickly, so you're constantly having to reinvent yourself to, to fit with the age. And I guess I started making films about 15 years ago now, and I've made a number of shorts and done television, and I've been writing scripts for a number of years, but this is the first one that I actually managed to get all the funding for and to get made. And, you know, it does take a long time. It's very competitive. You have to really prove prove yourself that you can be trusted with $6 million or whatever it's going to cost to make the film, that you have the credentials to do so. And people don't, you know, throw money at that sort of money at you if they don't really feel that you can pull it off.
Yeah. How did the Australians receive this film? Because obviously it sort of reflects on a certain culture.
It did very well in Australia. It did extremely well in Australia. And, we got many, many nominations. We were sort of very much neck and neck with another fantastic Australian film that came out this year called Samson and Delilah.
Yeah, Warwick Thornton, he'll be on the show too. Yeah.
Yes. So we were the two top films of last year.
Yeah, at the Affies and stuff. You were heavily nominated, which must have been very gratifying for you for your first feature. It's been a good start.
Yes, it was very rewarding and made me feel like I hadn't been barking up the wrong tree those years.
It presumably will not be your last feature.
I hope not. No, I have another few in the pipeline, and, you know, they take quite a lot to get up. You know, as I said, it's very competitive and it's a small market, and a lot of the art house cinemas are closing. And that happens to be my interest. I'm not interested in doing big budget remakes. So,
no, I don't think we want to see you do that. Rachel Ward, thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly. Congratulations on your film, Beautiful Kate, which is, as you say, a ripping yarn, and it kind of rips your heart out as well at certain points.
Oh, good.
As well.
Thank you. I'm so glad you said that.
Congratulations on your debut, and let it not be the last time that you go on Film Weekly, Rachel Ward.
Good on you. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks to Rachel Ward there. And Beautiful Kate is released here in the UK on Friday, the 30th of July. From Beautiful Kate to Handsome Zan Brooks, The Guardian's film critic, joins me. We'll be reviewing City Island this week. We'll look at The Rebound, and we'll also look at Giuseppe Tornatore's Baria. But Zan, let's start with City Island. Where is City Island?
City Island is a suburb of the Bronx, it turns out. I only know this from watching this film.
Yeah, I'd never heard of this place.
Not at all.
It's a fishing village in the Bronx.
Yes, and the Bronx still, in the public imagination, is the Badlands of New York. But whereas this is... I think they've got Riverdale up there as well, which is another very leafy suburb. So I guess it's kind of near there.
But that's where Andy Garcia lives, and that's where his family lives, and that's where he plays a prison guard. And that is where a young inmate comes to turn their lives around.
I was thinking this, you know, being a Saturday night and all, and Vivian's here. Why don't we have a big home-cooked dinner tonight? Big, nice, big.
Yeah, sure. Like I do every Saturday night.
Yeah, but like, you know, something special. You know, like for a real special occasion, something special, something nice.
You want balloons or something?
No, I don't want balloons or something. I'm just saying something nice.
When don't I make it nice?
Make something nicer!
Make it yourself! The great communicator.
Zan, Andy Garcia, who's an actor who kind of obviously a while ago was really, really hot and popular and good in a way. And then he's gone through this kind of really strange midlife career where he hasn't really had a decent part. Here he's producing a movie, presumably because he fancies the lead part in it himself. Does he acquit himself well?
Yes, he does. I think it's always good to see him in films, even though a lot of the films have been astonishingly ropey. He's a good old school presence. You know, obviously he sort of mostly came to fame with Godfather 3.
Yeah.
And there was a sense even then that he was an actor a little bit out of his time. That if he'd been born 10 years before, he would have had the Pacino De Niro career. But he's like sort of 10 years younger than them and has been slightly... ploughing a course in a different era.
Yeah, he's also an actor who kind of wears sunglasses all the time. He always seems to have the same trademark shades. Not quite Jack Nicholson ones, but he's a little bit more kind of roundy.
A bit more sophisticated, aren't
they? Yeah, I think so. They look it. I don't know if they kind of suit him. I've always thought he's so smiley. I think there's lots of good things for Andy Garcia to do. I remember, of course, the film that revived Richard Gere's career, Internal Affairs, that he did with for Mike Figgis, which was also really good.
Yeah, and Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, which was a good film.
Mm. And this one I thought was one of the best I've seen him do for a long time, playing this guy who kind of wants to have an acting class but has got his life kind of in the doldrums despite living in this kind of rather leafy suburb. It's the sort of place that you, as he says, if you lived there you wouldn't want to leave, and he sort of doesn't want to leave it, really. It's kind of his comfort zone. What did you think of this as a sort of family drama stroke comedy stroke romance?
Well, I actually liked the fact that it veered more towards the comedy. It's almost like a sort of comic melodrama, isn't it, this?
It's quite Italian in scope.
It's a bit Italian. It's a bit sort of a lot of broad kind of acting and you know, but it's got a sort of heart, I think, to it. And I liked it. And I liked Andy Garcia. I liked Juliana Margolis as his wife.
Yeah, she's good.
I liked Alan Arkin, of course, as his acting teacher. The thing about this is he's the prison guard who's got a terrible secret. And the terrible secret is that he wants to be an actor. He wants to be Marlon Brando. So he hides like his copy of An Actor Prepares in the toilet.
Yeah.
And tells his wife that he's going off to poker games because that's kind of, you know, legitimate.
She thinks he's having an affair. He's also got another secret as well, which is the fact that his long-lost son... from a previous relationship is now living with them because he's rescued him from prison. That's not any spoiler at all, because that happens in the first minute. And yet the rest of the family don't know that there's this kind of other son going on.
Yeah, and then, of course, the kids have their secrets too, that the daughter's dropped out of college and is now stripping in order to earn money to go back. The son is sort of addicted to internet porn.
He's a feeder.
He's a feeder.
Yeah, he likes to feed large women.
He does.
Lots of food.
And then actually meets one of them in his neighbourhood.
The wife has got a question. A secret as well, in that she's smoking still.
Yes, so it's like every family you've ever known.
It's done quite well in America, this film, City Island. It's a film by a guy called Raymond De Felita.
Familiar with him at all.
Yeah, he made a film about the secret jazz man nobody's heard of, Jackie Paris. We had him on the show, actually, and he was
He
was making this film at the time, and he sort of said, oh, I don't know what's going to happen to it, because it's, you know, a little indie project. And it's become quite a sleeper hit in the US. It sort of charmed audiences over the summer. I think it might do the same here. I kind of like it's not brilliant, of course, but I kind of liked it.
It's not brilliant. brilliant. It's one of those things that when I was watching it, I was thinking this maybe looks like a TV series. But that's no bad thing. It's got an intimacy and a warmth to it. And I enjoyed it.
And there's a bit where Andy Garcia probably does his best acting for many years. And he goes to an audition, an open audition for a Martin Scorsese movie with Robert De Niro. And he does it to camera piece. And when he kind of has to kind of do some acting.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a brilliant scene, actually. It was a real kind of, if he's going to get awards, this will be the clip that they would be showing. It was really funny and smartly played.
It's great. You know, an actor having to act is always a bit of a stretch, and he does it very well.
So that's City Island, and we sort of recommend that one in a kind of nice summer kind of surprise, little sparkling wine of a movie to go and see. Let's go to Barria. Let's go to Italy. Let's go on our summer holidays to Sicily and the land of Giuseppe Tornatore. And I call it that land of Giuseppe Tornatore because it is a land that only exists in this director's head. This is the man who gave us...
I've been to Sicily and it's not really
It
like
doesn't
this.
Look anything like this. Lots of little neo-realist dark-eyed boys running around in shorts wondering where the cinema has gone. He's the man who gave us Cinema Paradiso. Barria is, I think, the most expensive Italian movie ever made, an epic set on one street that spans the 1910s to the present day.
Io voglio il tuo cavallo! Hola, non odi! Soggiunse Orlando e con furor si mosse.
The strains of Ennio Morricone. Did the film put a strain on you as well?
The film strained me to breaking point. This is, I think, 2 hours, 45 minutes.
Yep. It feels every second.
I felt that I lived through 20th century Sicily. You know, this film opened the Venice Film Festival last year, and that's quite a significant thing to open the Venice Film Festival because it's been bankrolled by, I think, a company called Medusa, which is the sister company of Berlusconi's Mediaset empire. And this came with the big quote from Berlusconi, who says, "This is a film that all Italians need to see." because I made it.
Because I made it, and we need the box office.
Yeah.
They spent a lot of money reconstructing this area of Palermo. I don't know where they built it. In Africa somewhere, in Morocco, they built the set. Because it kind of takes one street in this area and kind of, you know, populates it over the years. So you get a little boy starting out in 1910, and then he becomes a sort of politician, and then then we follow his son. I didn't really know whose story... it was telling. It was neither that of Italy's politics.
It's Italy's story, supposedly.
But it wasn't, was it? Because there was a lot of... they go through Il Duce, they go through the war, they go through the fascism.
Big labour struggles.
Yeah. But they sort of all...
lots of pretty ladies.
Yes,
in
they're not pretty enough. Normally in these films, I expect...
there's a lot of ogling. There's a lot of ogling of the shapely ankle as she walks up the street.
But normally in these films, you get Monica Bellucci in a kind of summer dress.
Well, you've got Monica Bellucci in here.
I couldn't hardly spot her. Where was she?
Oh, I can't remember. But she does. She genuinely
she's
does.
She's supposed
pop
to be
up.
In it, but yeah. I was waiting. I was 2.5 hours. I'm waiting for Bellucci, and I couldn't find. But you know, Amacord. You know, that's a big cleavage movie. Il Postino with that big cleavage movie. It's very sort of restrained in its cleavage. This film is my main criticism of it. Obviously,
I can't believe you're saying this film is restrained because it's everything's over the top.
Only
in the cleavage department,
which is the only thing that's not over the top of the dresses. But no, it is a hugely sentimental affair.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like
lots of people shouting at each other over dinner tables and then hugging each other and then punching each other.
Lots of farmers kind of harvesting olives and stealing things, and then each scene kind of moulds into like then we suddenly jump forward.
Yeah, jump forward 10 years.
You know, there was a bit of it. There were kind of moments what I quite liked along the way. There were some sort of decent.
There's
bits
some great set pieces in there. And I had a kind of sneaking admiration for its hubris, I suppose. Its absolute abandon in, I'm going to slap this history of Italy down on the canvas and this is going to be, you know, this is going to be it. This is definitive. But within that, it's a lot of horseshit, really. I mean, it really doesn't add up at all. And it's horribly sentimental. And I guess what Berlusconi likes about it is that the main character, Peppino, becomes deeply involved in the communist cause and then realises that communism is actually really bad and so sort of drifts away from that.
Zach, let's move on to maybe something better, maybe not, Catherine Zeta-Jones. Three of my least favourite words in the world when put together. Here she is in a new romantic comedy called The Rebound.
Oh, that's gross. Oh, Frank!
What are you doing up?
Was Aaron peeing on you?
No! Fred, no! I would never do that!
Okay. Are you sleeping over?
No.
No. No?
Oh, well. Don't forget your pants.
Well, that sounds extremely amusing. Little child catching Catherine Zeta-Jones at it with her young Manny. Do you know what a Manny is?
I do now, yeah, and see, I wish I coined I didn't. It.
She's right on the pulse, Catherine Zeta-Jones, with this film. Written and directed by Bart Freundlich.
Yeah, this is a very depressing career trajectory, isn't it? Because Bart Freundlich was once long ago one of the leading lights of sort of East Coast indie cinema.
Supposed to have been for that film, The Myth of Fingerprints, which I thought was crap.
Well, I kind of liked it. No, I mean, it was a little bit navel-gazy, a little bit up itself, but I quite liked it.
It's where he met his wife, Julianne Moore, who is considerably older than him. Well, not considerably. Some years older than him. Yeah. And so that is the thing that plays out in this film, because she plays a woman who's divorced and then kind of falls in love with her young Manny.
I hope their relationship doesn't bear any relation to this at all.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do worry about how long they've got, Julie. I mean, if Julianne Moore thought this was good and he came, she said, "Oh, nice day at the office, dear." Yeah. And he said, "I've made this." You know, she's doing good work still.
She's doing great work.
I don't know how he can show his face at
not. Home. No, exactly. He should be ashamed of himself, shouldn't he, making this? You know, you call it romantic comedy, but that's just false advertising, isn't it? Because it's not romantic, and it's sure as hell is it funny.
So what is it?
It's a disaster.
The Rebound. Go see that if that review really takes your fancy. Zan, there is what I would call a romantic, perhaps comedy of sorts, re-released to mark the death of Eric Rohmer, who died earlier this year at the age of 89. Ma Nuit chez Maud, or My Night at Maud's, gets a rare big screen outing. I hadn't seen this for 20 years.
Really?
Yeah, and there it was up on the big screen. Is it a classic?
I think it's a classic. I like Roma, and I think that this is one of his very best.
Why?
I think it taught Richard Linklater all he knows, but that's almost like a byproduct. I think
School of Rock.
It's really like School of Rock.
Il est impossible de ne pas reconnaître, c'est sa contradiction.
Tu sais, je suis très imperméable à la dialectique.
C'est ce qui fait la force des types comme Pascal. T'as quand même lu Pascal.
Oui, l'homme est un roseau pensant.
It's about conversation, I guess, and about how conversation can be as stimulating, as sensual, as erotically charged as actual sex. It's about a Catholic engineer who spends the eponymous night with
Jean-Louis Trintignant.
With Maud, who is a sort of free-thinking cerebral doctor who challenges all of his ideas.
She's
and
a divorcee,
prejudices.
And he's quite devout. Yes. And he's already sworn that he will marry a woman he's seen in church.
He has, which then leads on to actually one of the most oddly erotic scenes in cinema, where he is with this woman who he will then later marry, and goes to borrow a match from her, goes into her room when they're snowed in. And it's just this wonderful little charged moment of two people coming together, but not quite coming together.
1969, it was his breakthrough film, Roma. Zan Brooks, nice to see you. Thank you very much for coming in. You can, of course, read all of Zan's musings about film and see some of his talkings about film on guardian.co.uk/film. Nowhere is the world of cinema more vibrant than in South America at the moment, and to celebrate that, author Demetrius Matthew has written a favour book of new South American cinema. He's also programmed a month of films down at the BFI South Bank called The South American Renaissance to illustrate his book, and I'm delighted to say he joins me in the Film Weekly studio now. Welcome, Demetrius.
Hi, Jason.
Welcome back from your travels. Where has this taken you, this book?
Brazil. Argentina and Chile.
Oh, nice.
And all kinds of other places.
Is that how you thought? You thought, well, you're sitting at home here in London thinking, well, it's all rainy. You think, do you know what I need to do? But I'm not going to do Czech cinema or Nordic cinema. I'm going to go somewhere exotic. I'm going to do South American film. So what was the starting point then for the new South American cinema? When did the new come into South American cinema? Is there a moment?
On the ground, I'd say in the mid-90s, really. And I mean, each country obviously has its different experience. But Brazil, for example, started making films again in the mid-90s. Immediately after the dictatorship, ironically, it had its first democratically elected president cut all funding from cinema. I think there were no films made in 1990, one in 91. But then he was impeached, departed, new government, they started a new audiovisual fund. So basically the government started funding films again. And then a whole bunch of a new generation of directors took the opportunity, got stuck in. So I'd say from the mid-90s, Argentina, late 90s, Chile, 2000 is all. You could almost make a clockwise trip around the continent,
right? Seeing how films kick started. When you look at, say, the French New Wave, for example, you know that Truffaut's 400 Blows sort of started it, and then you know Jean-Luc Godard's Boudicouf came along, and then you started your wave. What's the real one that you kind of look at, the landmark kind of moment in New South American cinema?
I think really, because of the way that it announced this renaissance to the rest of the world and also attracted foreign money to the rest of into South America, I think Central Station, Walter Salles' Central Station, which won the Golden Bear in Berlin in 1998. I mean, that was a big, big deal. But in terms of having that presence in the international arena, I would say that closely followed by City of God.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's a beautiful film, Central Station, but kind of melancholic and kind of, you know, smaller in a way. But City of God announced itself in a kind of blaze of colour and energy, and a riot basically broke out after that screening in Cannes.
Yeah, it just came out of nowhere, blew everybody away. And as you say, what was interesting was that it was such a dynamic film. And I think this is what a number of the South Americans do. They actually tell their own stories, very local stories, but in such a way that engages incredibly well with the rest of the world. That was a very, very exciting piece of movie making.
Yeah, absolutely. And the music as well, obviously, to capture the bit the sway of the Brazilian samba, the sexiness of the beach, as well as the kind of... there did seem to be... what was great about City of God is that there was a sort of social aspect to it. When you discover the director, this was a kind of an urbane man, a cultured man, Fernando Moreira's, Walter Salles himself was an urbane, cultured man. This wasn't... They were not urchins with movie cameras. They actually sort of had a kind of a definite political ideology in their very exciting movie making as well.
I think they had an idea of what was going on in their country. Again, this is a common theme across the countries. They had a strong idea of what was going on. In Morales's case, as you say, it wasn't his experience, but he was aware of it. He'd made a film before that, very small, as a practice run, really, called Maids, which was about domestic servants in Sao Paulo.
Yes, I got that, Domesticas.
Yeah, it's a lovely little film. So I think they were aware of what was going on. Also, you know, quite selfishly, they wanted to make movies, and they're not stupid. I mean, he's not a stupid man. He could see this incredibly engaging story.
Yeah, it's a film of a great beauty, which I love, and I've always felt a great humanity in it. And I mentioned earlier political ideology. Yeah. It seems to me that there is a sort of social humanism that runs through these directors in some way. I know that I once spoke to Walter Salles and on this show, and he told us that I was very surprised that he found Ken Loach a big influence on his work. And I think it's obviously not stylistic, but it's obviously, I think that it comes through in his kind of humanity for the characters and the places.
I think so. And another good example of that is Pablo Trapero in Argentina.
He's a fantastically interesting film.
He's a really interesting director. And we've got...
What Trapero films, but might our listeners know?
Well, we have Crane World that's in The Season, which is his first film. And when I was talking about Central Station announcing Brazil to the world, Crane World, in a way, did that for Argentina. El Bonorenzi, this fantastic film about a guy who kind of casually, accidentally becomes a cop and is an awful, awful policeman in Buenos Aires.
Yeah.
And about the corruption in the police force.
That's a great cop film, isn't it? Yeah.
It's an amazing film. Rolling Family, which is a road movie. The South Americans like road movies. Well, the Latin Americans
like
road movies.
There's a lot of roads. I think there's quite a big difference. La Familia Rodante, isn't it? The Rolling Family. That's a beautiful film.
Yeah. Wonderful film about a dysfunctional family in a motorhome on the road. It's very funny, very real.
I mean, obviously we're talking about Salles, we're talking about Trapero and Moraes. Have you found films while you were going further in and directors that you particularly got a soft spot for? I mean, one of my favourites, and I mentioned this, is an Argentinian guy, Carlos Sorin, who did the lovely film, well, he did that, the short story film, the Historias Minimas.
Historias Minimas.
Which sort of completely wowed me over and won me over and loved. And then he did that film about the dog, which was brilliant.
Bon Bon El Perro.
Was there anyone like him that you discovered, that characters that you sort of fell in love with and became your new favourite filmmaker as you were going along?
I was already, with Carlos Sorin, I was already familiar with him, but I met him in Buenos Aires, and the most fantastic fellow. I mean, one of the joys of doing this book was travelling around and meeting these fantastic people who have such real histories as well as films. I discovered Lisandro Alonso in Buenos Aires.
I don't know.
Largely through... He's very much kind of film festival person. You're lucky to see we're lucky to see his films outside of film festivals. We've got his latest film, Liverpool, in the season. Very kind of austere, vigorous minimalism, but funny and unusual and dangerous. His first film, La Libertad, was basically about his father's lumberjack.
Right.
But it becomes almost an existential drama. It's about a lumberjack.
Right.
It's fantastic.
To go with, it is interesting writing a film book. You always think, well, perhaps I should illustrate it with some ways. And your book has sort of a few pictures in it, but it's not a picture, but it's, not a coffee table. But you have this handy season at the BFI where you can kind of show the films that you illustrated. Putting that together, and you've got the kind of the hits, The City of Gods and the Walter Salles movies. But there are some kind of films in there that I haven't seen, some discoveries in there.
Yeah.
Can you just take us through a couple of those that you like? Well, what's this film, Whiskey? I think I did see that.
Whiskey is a Uruguayan film by Pablo Stolin, Juan Pablo Rubella, which is marvellous. It's a very dour comedy. It's a little, it reminds you of Aki Kaurismäki a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
But it's an incredibly funny film.
There's a film in there called Blondes. Is it the Blondes?
Yeah, The Blondes.
What's that?
The Blondes is a different animal altogether. First of all, it's a documentary. It's Argentine. Made by a woman called Albertina Carey. Both her parents were disappeared. The documentary is about normally about her investigation of what happened to them. But it's just incredibly inventive. She hires an actor to play herself. So that you've got kind of this actress pretending to be Albertina Carey in front of the cameras, interviewing people, neighbours and such like, who were around when her parents were abducted and basically turned a blind eye.
Yeah.
But then we can see Albertina Carey filming the action. So you've got Albertina Carey filming Albertina Carey, investigating the death of
her parents.
So
a smart documentary.
It's an incredibly smart movie.
The season at BFI. Demetrius Matthew, thank you very much for taking us through the congratulations on your new book on the whole South America. I didn't even mention the words Buena Onda, which is what we call this new wave. Isn't that right? If you want to be impress your friends at dinner, call it the Buena Onda,
It's the beginning of the new wave, followed by all kinds of other waves.
Can they sustain this new wave? That's always good to have a new wave, but can you sustain it?
They've got the same problems as we all have. Money, getting people into the cinemas to watch their own films rather than American films. But they've got a good crack at it.
I
think it's amongst the best cinema in the world at the moment.
Brilliant. Well, your book nails it. The Faber Book of a New South American Cinema. It's author Demetrius Matthew. Go and see his films down, a selection of films. You didn't make any of them. His selection of films at BFI Southbank throughout August. Demetrius, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And you can find out more about that South American Renaissance season at BFI Southbank by going to bfi.org.uk. The music featured on this week's podcast is, of course, from the brilliant soundtrack to Fernando Moreira's City of God, a soundtrack to have in every discerning collection, methinks. It's been in my car since 2002. Never off. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this week for the brilliant review section of the best film news and reviews. But from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.